Welcome to all who gather in the name of the Lord this Sunday, this Lord's Day afternoon. Please join me in Revelation chapter 2. This afternoon I speak of hope and watermelons. I speak of hope because I want it, because I need it, because I read at the end of 1 Corinthians 13 that hope abides, and I want it to abide with me. I want to abide with hope. But I also believe that that's not an accident. It's not something that some people are just born to, just like good cheer. Some people are that way, but they're not just born there, or at least most are not. It is something that has to be sought. It has to be cultivated. It has to be nurtured. And I hope to use the text named on the screen as the basis, as a place to consider for hope. I hope you'll join me in that this evening. I choose watermelons because I want you to think about a very particular image. Don't get me wrong. I'm not talking about the taste of watermelons. I don't even like it. I'm not even talking about that memory you have of watermelon juice dripping off your elbow when you were eating it at age 10 with your cousins. That's delightful, and it's a marvelous memory, but that's not what I'm thinking about. There's one particular event associated with a watermelon that I want to draw on tonight. It's a little image, not like the fantastic images in Revelation, but I want to use it tonight and see if we can work it for a little advantage. I want you to think with me about that perhaps long-lost phenomenon where you actually cut open your own watermelon. And everybody who had a grandfather who did that in 1961 and had a special knife with a really long blade, even a pocket knife that folded, but it was a really long blade. And you would slip that in there and you'd start that first slice, and then you'd break it open. It's not just the sight of the knife and the slice. It's the sound of that rind cracking. You know that sound, and it's marvelous. And then you break it open, and it's there with a remarkable splash of color. And then you do the wonderful things that people do with that. Get those little scoops and scoop out melon balls and shape nice little triangles that are so colorful, with that curved green rind, and place them geometrically on plates, and it's an astonishing event. But we're not going that far. We're just going to that first slice. And I see it as a slice of wonder. And I want to think about the book of Revelation being a watermelon tonight. Let me note for you a couple of other things that happened to watermelons. I certainly remember this as a youngster. You could see rotting watermelons in the field. And rather than being round and robust, they're all shrunken and shriveled, limp, got bugs crawling in them. But you understand, using the image that I'm thinking about, that we end up making Revelation too often like that. We let Revelation rot in the field because we don't know how to slice it. Okay, it's a weird figure. Just go with me a bit. Of course, there's another possibility, and some of you were in the presence of limitless watermelon may remember if you're a 10-year-old boy, that what you do with them is you just pick them up and slam them on the ground and let them break into big chunks, and then the melee is on, and you just grab and smear and drip. That's another way, and maybe there are people who approach Revelation that way, and I don't recommend that, but I want to talk about different ways of slicing this book. And so there are several, and if you don't like a slice, just set it aside. We'll get another watermelon, and we'll slice it a different way and see if that works better. But remember, the goal in all of this is, can I take this book and use it as a source of hope? So, here are different ways that I can offer to you the book of Revelation. First, I can offer it to you in one word. So this is my first slice. I'm going to reach in there. You know what it's like. Pull out the very heart. You don't care about that whole watermelon. There are hundreds around. I'm going for the heart. I want you to know that the book of Revelation can be digested to a single word. And if you're a seventh grader studying Revelation with me right now, I hope you know that if somebody asks you what Revelation is about, I hope you give them that one word and you say to them, it's a book about overcoming. And now here you see in chapter 2, four times, and then immediately following in chapter 3, three more times. And you see how this corresponds. Seven letters in those two chapters. Each letter has this word in it. To him who overcomes. This is a book about overcoming. And so the question for a reader is, will you be an overcomer? Now, when I ask for hope, I'm not asking for ease. I'm not asking for a free pass. I'm not asking for a giveaway. I'm not asking for a door prize. Those are not reasonable expectations. The way the world works, the way a broken world works, is it requires of us work. And so when I see that overcoming is here, well, that tells me two things. One, it has to be done to him who does overcome. But secondly, it can be done. And I can hope in that possibility. I'm not stuck in helplessness. I can overcome. Revelation tells me that. To him who overcomes, I will give something. Now, let me tell you, it may be in your version, if you're reading in the English Standard Version, it uses the word conquer. Seven times, to him who conquers. One word, it's a different word. If you like overcome better, hang on to that. And I can't resist, this is a version that appears in chapter 17. Other slight variations appear, and of course it's Greek, I don't know anything about this, but could resist because you do know this word. These are simply forms of that. So the next time you have a doubt if you can overcome, think about your feet. Right? You can Nike. In fact, in famous example, Romans chapter 8, you are more than conquerors. You're just not Nikeo people, you're hooper Nikeo. Hyper, over conquerors. It's hope comes with just a single word that's repeated at least a dozen times throughout the book, seven times in these letters. I hope you won't give up on the book of Revelation because it's too weird. I hope you'll join me in going back to it and saying, yes, I've got to do it. I've got to overcome, but it can be done. If you're not satisfied with my one word, then let's try one verse. And that's 17:14. Revelation 17:14. I encourage you to commit it to memory. They shall make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them. Ah, there it is, right there. The Lamb will conquer them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called and chosen and faithful. Now notice this, in chapter 2, to him who overcomes, we have to be overcomers. And please don't mistake me, I'm not suggesting Revelation tells us we rely on our own efforts. Here, it's not us overcoming, the Lamb overcomes. Now, this verse doesn't tell us who they are. And we can go back and check the context, and we can enter into the rather extravagant imagery of chapter 17 and the other chapters. But for our purposes, they references several different beings and figures and images. But the point is that there is a war. So here I'm going to suggest to you the three points that come to my mind when I think about this one particular verse. See, that's a new watermelon of Revelation. I slice into it. I say, this verse will give me a place to grab hold, to hang on, to squeeze everything I can out of it. And when I do, this is what I see. There is a fight. The Lamb wins, and he's not alone. Do you understand? In my mind, you say, well, a fight doesn't sound very hopeful. Well, it might be nice if there were no fights, but if there is one, it's nice to know that it's coming. It's nice to know so I can ready myself for my part. Now, again, I'm not suggesting that we win the fight. I remind myself and you of 2 Chronicles chapter 20, where the prophet speaking for God says, you don't fight today. The battle is the Lord's. You do have something to do in 2 Chronicles 20. You have to stand firm, hold your position, and see the salvation of the Lord. We get to see that. We get to do the same thing. We get to watch the fight. There is a fight. But we know who wins. And this, the hope lies in both of these things. The Lamb wins, and he's not alone. If the Lamb's not alone, then that gives me hope. I can be one of those. Because we're told what it takes to be one of those. Those who are with the Lamb, those who win with the Lamb, those who participate in his victory are those who are called and chosen and faithful. Can I be those things? I have hope. I have hope that I can be faithful. One verse offering you a way to see hope in this. Now I'm going to turn to three questions. If you don't like those two slices, we'll try another one. And this is actually extra textual. It's not from the text itself. This is my pulling out of three questions that come to mind when I think about the book. Some of you have heard me mention these before, but I liken it to a child going through a serious medical procedure, maybe not even a child, probably old men too. There is a desire to know, how bad is this going to be? Some people, like my wife in childbirth, just give me every drug known to man. But there are people who want to know what they're facing. And here's a chance. How bad will it be? Who will be there with me? Am I going to be alone? Will you be there with me? I'll be right outside the door. Or, increasingly in childbirth, that father had better be right there in the middle of things. And will it be worth it? Ladies and gentlemen, three questions to ponder. And they're questions that give me a sense of hope. Because they give some sense of the shape, the boundaries of this experience. It's not a denial that bad things are happening, challenging things are happening, but it's an affirmation that there is a limit to it. In fact, I will tell you that it seems to me, if you read through the chapter 8 of Revelation, how bad will it be? The answer is 1/3. That's how bad it's going to be, and that's pretty bad. But it's not all bad, and it's not forever bad. It's partial, and it's limited. There's hope in that, hope for my ability to endure. And then my hope lies also in the fact that when it's over, there will have been something to come out of this. My conquering, my participating in the conquering of Jesus will bring me somewhere worth being. Read Revelation with that in mind. And we'll read some more that will take us to those places. Next, a new slice. Pick up another watermelon. And now I want you to think about, this is just kind of a structural oddity that I want to perhaps impose on the text, but I believe it's there. And that is to understand that Revelation is offered to us in two different layers. And we have trouble sometimes. I'm shifting my food examples. My mind goes to food a lot. But this makes you think of chicken fried steak. Sometimes you cut into a piece. You know what it's like. You cut into it, after you threw cutting, there wasn't any meat. It was all crust, right? You've done that. All right. But see, we're thinking about layers here in the book of Revelation. Here's what I want you to think about. First, as the seventh graders are learning so patiently and attentively this quarter, book of Revelation is by its name a book of revealing. And so the statement that occurs as much as anything in the book, John says again and again and again, I saw. God revealed, John saw, and not only did he see, he testified, he witnessed to what he saw. And so we have a collection of extravagant sights, and I believe people get lost in those. They get lost in those and don't know what to do with them. I don't know what to do with them. Often. Is it there to connect us back to similar images from the Old Testament? Yes, I think so. Is it there to show us fights dramatically? Yes. And don't you know, what my favorite weird sight in this whole book is a red dragon chasing a pregnant woman in the sky. That's weird. And you can't take away the weirdness. It's there. Just let it be weird. Wallow in it. But don't get lost. And then, of course, chapter 17, verse 14, there's a war and the lamb wins. You don't picture a war lamb. It's a weird picture. It's an extravagant sight. And later, the conqueror on the white horse, with his name written on his thigh. Is it a tattoo? That's what I wanted. And see, this is a book of extravagant sights. And so I'm not trying to deny or diminish those. I'm happy to puzzle over them, rehearse them regularly, but I'm not going to get lost in them because I'm going to remember that there is a second level. And it's not nearly as extravagant. It's not nearly as eye-appealing and eye-catching as when you slice that watermelon, you see that bright red shine forth, or you see the wretchedness of the interior, but still that exposing of what's inside. The dramatic sights are different from what I'm suggesting. Here's the term that I'm using for this other part. These commonplace chores. After all is said and done, after all of the fancy images are offered to us, there's a thread that runs through the book that says, do these things. And for me, if I get lost in the sights, I can find hope in the commonplace chores. Let me show you a few of those. And by the way, the examples I'm giving cluster just squarely in the center of the book. I don't believe it's accidental. Keep the commandments. Hold the testimony. Keep the faith. Endure. This is a call for endurance, the text says twice in these adjacent chapters. So look, three chapters, just pretty squarely in the middle of the book. They come right after the Ark of the Covenant is revealed in the temple in heaven, which is the exact center of the book. Can I do these things? Yes, I can. Can I hope in these? Yes. If I fret over loss, confusion in the extravagant sights, I can retreat to the commonplace chores and say, I've got to overcome. How do I overcome? I keep the commandments. I hold the testimony. I keep the faith. I endure. And I can do that. I can hope. So if you're ever tempted to ignore Revelation because it's beyond me, then what you've done is you've let it be that watermelon rotting in the field. And I'm inviting you to take that big long knife and slice it just right here, right in the middle of this watermelon, and look at those weird sights, and then dig through it and see places where I can act hopefully. Take you back to chapter 1, that a verse I've noted in other settings here. it seems to be something of a distillation of these observations. I, John, your brother and partner with you. So I think that's a brilliant rhetorical move right there. Right? Look at this remarkable act of naming. He could have just said, I. But then he names himself. And that's not even enough. He wants to say, I'm your brother. That's, to me, like the let us of Hebrews. It's not John saying, I've got this figured out. The mystery is now clear in my mind, and I'm passing it on to you. He's saying, I'm in there with you right now. I am your brother, and I'm a partner with you. We're doing this together. That's a reason to hope. I want you to know, Nana has a knack for this, otherwise known as Nancy. There are times when three grandchildren I know fret. My temptation is to out-fret them, to fret louder than they can, to fret harsher than they can, more harshly. But Nana knows, let's figure out a way to wade into this together and see what delight we can discover by being in the middle of it, and here's the emphasis, together. I, John, your brother and partner with you. Look what he's a partner in. I'm a partner with you in tribulation. This is not some magical time period that some people want to picture. It seems to me just plain trouble, like John uses in the Gospel of John, chapter 16, the very last verse of the chapter, I believe, or the next to the last. I'm a partner with you in trouble. I'm a partner in you with something that has to be overcome. But we can do it. And partly we can do it because we're not only partners in trouble, we are partners in a kingdom. And brothers and sisters, I hope tonight, because I believe with Paul that my citizenship is in heaven. I believe with Paul that I can enter the kingdom. And part of the way I can do that, and it's not the only way, we'll talk about that in a little while. But notice this, the third thing. I'm a partner with you, not only in tribulation and kingdom, I'm a partner with you in patient endurance. Remember, that was one of the commonplace chores, is to endure. I promise you, if you look at the first two chapters and the first three chapters, you'll find it five or six times is reference to patient endurance. So that's another slice. I may not even get past chapter 3, but I can open it up and I can read. I'm looking for patient endurance. I find it here. I find it there. I find it again and again. I can hope because I know that one of the practices of hope is patient endurance. And I'm going to talk about wives here tonight. You know this. Many of you wives had to raise your husband. Maybe I'm just speaking about my home. But you understand that, maybe I'm sure many of you were brilliantly gifted as husbands from the outset. Others of us are still learning, and our wives practice patient endurance. We can practice that. We can hope. I hope you'll join me in that. This is my last one. Revelation in gifts. And I hope you see this takes us back to the question of, will it be worth it? Will it be worth it after the badness, the tribulation? Will it be worth it after I have overcome? Remember, in Revelation, to him who overcomes, I will give. Early in the book, gifts are offered. The end of the book, in fact, if you'll ask me sometime, I'll tell you how I think the structure of the letters is the structure of the whole book as well. The gifts are at the end of every letter, And they're at the end of the whole book. The last couple of chapters address gifts. And so I want to talk about two places in the last two chapters. So join me there. Chapter 21, 1 through 4. Then we'll go a little bit more in chapter 1. And then we'll turn to chapter 22. This is talking about gifts. It answers the question, will it be worth it? It answers the question, when all is said and done, what will we have? Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, you know it's serious when you get to behold. Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. Notice the repetitions. He will dwell with them, and then he'll be with them as their God. With them is in there twice, and God himself will be there. This emphasis on this circumstance is not, it's not just a geography lesson, although I think it is that. It is an invitation to being part of this kingdom. It's an invitation to being part of those who are called and chosen and faithful, because those are the people who God says are his people. Do you understand the greatest source of hope for me lies in this simple fact? God wants a people. I can hope because he does. And when he has his people, he's going to be with them. And then look what he says. The gifts keep going. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. I want you to know, as an older man, I cry more and more. I cry more easily. And I don't even mind anymore. But I can hope, as I read here, that that's not the way it's always going to be. I can hope. I invite you to join me in that. Continuing on, in the same chapter, a few more verses. He who was seated on the throne said, behold, there it is again, I am making all things new. Also he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. And he said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of water, of the water of life without payment. Notice there's the language of gift. I will give. This is like the woman at the well, right? The fountain flowing up to eternal life. Here, Jeremiah has similar language. Notice in verse 7, though, we'll get back to that other language, the one who conquers, the one who overcomes, the one who wears the shoes will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. I'll be glad to be corrected about this, but this is at least one of the few times, if not the only time, where God's statement about a people gets repeated with a reference to just an individual. It's one-on-one. And that's pretty intriguing to me, because the letters begin, every letter begins to a church, but every letter ends to him who overcomes. There's a collective component, there's an individual component, and sorting that out is the work of our hope, I believe. Here now, the last passage, chapter 22, the very last chapter of the Bible, last chapter of Revelation, first five verses. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, through the middle of the street of the city. Also, on either side of the river, the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. No longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads, and night will be no more. They will need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever. We sing songs about this because we practice our hope. And here, at the last chapter, we're almost back at the first, because we're back in a garden-like setting. Not perfectly. Tree of life, though, river, garden-like pieces are there. The previous chapter has a city, so here the image of garden and city are merged. But both are meant to be pictures of hope, better than watermelons. And so tonight, I hope you'll purpose in the next month sometime to sit down and read some part of Revelation. I've shown you how the very beginning, I've shown you how the very end, I've shown you how chapters 12, 13, 14, those places and places in between as well, offer us particular hope. They give us a chance to break into this weird text and find the wonderful things that God intends for us. When I say weird, you understand I'm not criticizing God and his intentions. But I stand by my claim that a red dragon chasing a pregnant woman through the sky is a weird picture. It's our job to see the hope in that. Let's do that. Tonight, I've invited you to look at a text and to see it with expectant eyes, eyes that anticipate hope. And I believe we can do that. I hope you can be a reader of hope. I hope you can be a bearer of hope to other people. Because you know, sitting right here now are people who need a little bit of extra dollop of hope. And you can be the spreader of grace. You can be the voice that calls people to say, there's overcoming to do. It's not easy, and I know it's not easy. But you can do it, and I want to be there with you. Let me suggest to you that you can only do that if you've had that first glimpse. And now I'm shifting to the story of God as a watermelon. Have you broken it open and seen for the first time that there's a way that I can be part of God's people? That's my start. And then after there, it's the patient endurance. Let's live it out. Let's flourish in this relationship. But it starts with somebody seeing the hope that lies in the establishment of a covenant relationship with the God of the universe. It starts with someone saying, I want to be there when the Lamb wins. Or when the Lamb's full victory is revealed. The winning's already happened. Will we be on his side? As I tell the youngsters, everybody gets a t-shirt. Which t-shirt will you wear? Which mark will you have on your forehead? As the text tells us in Revelation. But it may be tonight that there's someone among us who needs to say, I want to make my first step seeking hope. I want to stand up in front of an audience of people and make the good confession, not a confession of sin, but a confession of who Jesus is. Jesus is the Lamb who wins. He is the Lamb who leads a partnership of those who will be with him when he wins. That's the confession we make. And having done that, we say, I want to ready myself to be his partner. So I'm going to be immersed in water. And I'm going to rise out of that water, having had my sins washed away. Not because there's any magical power in the water, but it's what my partner in a relationship says I need to do. It's what the covenant caller says. Take this ceremony as a sign that we started. In fact, it is a tremendous ceremony of hope. I still remember my occasion of being baptized as a young adult. And I remember sitting there while this guy was at about the very point I am in the talking. And I was looking at this verse as, does that verse really fit what he's doing here? But here's what I said in my mind. This is no time for quibbling. It's time for me to get up and walk. And I did. I went to the front of that little building in Kentucky. And I was baptized right there. And I came out of that water a partner with the Lord of the universe. And in that I have hope. 41 years later, I have hope. And you can too, if you need to do that. But I'm hoping that everyone can see this as an opportunity to find a new place to look in the text and say, yes, I know all of these things. I've even heard the watermelon before. But I can go back there and I can read it and I can grab hold of that and say, here I stand, here I hope, because there is one who wins. Tonight, will you renew your covenant in your own heart? That's all I'm saying, not nothing for many of you. For others, somebody might need to start a covenant by coming forward. However you need to respond to the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ, please do so now as we stand and as we sing.